So it's been more than 3 weeks since Election Day in the United States, and yet it seems that we are only now seeing a transition of power. There have been lawsuits and press conferences and accusations of voter fraud and recount and a leaking Rudy Giuliani. But now the head of the General Services Administration has signalled the beginning of a formal transition process, a sign that Donald Trump may be moving towards acceptance that he has lost. And a Philadelphia appeals court has denied on Friday the Trump campaign's attempt to challenge a lower court loss that had sought to stop or even reverse the certification of election results in Pennsylvania, just the latest in a legal defeat by the Trump campaign. Joining us is Alex Burns, the national political correspondent of the New York Times, and he's a regular on the news podcast, The Daily, political analyst at CNN. Hi, Alex. How are you?
Great. Thank you for having me.
Let's just talk about this Philadelphia appeals court decision. The judge that threw the Trump campaign's attempt out is a Republican appointee, a Trump appointee. The three-judge panel are all appointed by Republicans. And yet we hear from Trump's lawyers that the activist judicial machinery in Pennsylvania has covered up allegations of massive fraud and they're going to appeal. What are they talking about?
Well, the short answer is I couldn't really tell you what they're talking about in terms of what they believe the substance of their complaint is, but they have amassed this incredible losing streak in court, including in some of the more conservative courts in the country. And it really has exposed the flimsiness, not just of the president's litigation, but of the whole underlying assumption that Republican-appointed judges and conservative-appointed judges would be willing to give him a broad latitude to challenge the election. He's really out of legal options at this point. What you see now is, and perhaps what we've been seeing for some time, is sort of litigation for litigation's sake, that you can file lawsuits as a public relations matter and then take that lawsuit and use it as sort of, you know, one data point in an argument that supposedly the fight is still on, the election isn't truly over, but everybody knows the election is over, and including seemingly increasingly the president himself.
So what's the point in notching up loss after loss? What is it doing for them?
Well, it's not doing anything practical and constructive for them. What it appears to be doing is giving the president a pretext for not actually acknowledging in his own words that he has lost the election. And it's worth noting here that when lawsuits are, you know, typically you don't file a frivolous lawsuit because you don't want to be humiliated in court and you don't want to spend the money that it costs to litigate. Well, some of these lawsuits are being brought by entities besides the president, so he's not paying for them. Some of them are being brought on his behalf by political entities that are funded with donor money, not with his own money. He clearly doesn't mind being effectively laughed out of court. So the traditional deterrents against essentially joke litigation are not really in play here. And what he's doing instead is he's creating this fog of, again, it's not real uncertainty, but the way it plays on the American right-wing media in some corners of the conservative internet is that this allows the president to then say, no, I haven't really lost. This has been stolen from me. Or, no, I haven't really lost. There's still uncertainty about the outcome. I don't think there's a strategy that's more developed than that.
So he's going above the law to address at least some of the 74 million people in the United States who voted for him and whom he hopes to convince that the system is completely rigged.
And it's possible that that serves some medium-term purpose for him. If he decides he wants to run for office again, perhaps this bonds the Republican Party's conservative base even more tightly to him. It's possible that it serves a commercial purpose for him, that if after leaving office he wants to go into the media business more directly or other commercial enterprises where it's useful for him to have this brand as a sort of victimized a conservative president, that maybe it could be useful for him in that way, as a short-term political matter, as a practical matter of, you know, trying to resolve the election. All he's doing at this point, you know, he's not even really obstructing the process of resolving the election at this point. That's what he was doing a week ago or 2 weeks ago. At this point, he's just kind of dragging out a legal fight that he's already lost.
I mean, the cost, as you say, donations may be paying a lot of it, but it's bound to be costing him an awful lot of money. Has he got that much money? What do we know about his financial situation?
Well, again, this may not cost him a dime out of his own personal bank account, that he's been very successful at raising money from both very, very wealthy donors and then large numbers of less wealthy donors on the internet. And he has the resources of his campaign, the Republican National Committee, and again, other outside conservative entities that are not funded with his own money. So I wouldn't assume that he pays any financial price for this whatsoever. But in terms of his personal finances, what, you know, some of my colleagues have reported at the Times is that the president has clearly lost business since entering office, that his hotel and real estate empire and branding empire has explored a number of overseas business opportunities, but not followed through on them while he's been in office. I would expect that there's a pretty good chance that that will change as soon as he's out of office. But that most importantly, he has debt in the hundreds of millions of dollars coming due next year. And it's sort of not clear at this point, based on the information we have today, how he is going to resolve those debt obligations. And so I do think that there's a level at which the sort of dance that you're seeing him engage in right now, if you can call it that, is aimed at positioning himself for whatever the next fight is, whether it's a political one, a legal one, or a financial one against his creditors.
Let's talk about the legal issues. The predictions were that were Trump to lose the election, so too would he lose his immunity to a criminal charge. He could pardon himself from federal charges. Could he or not?
Well, we actually don't really know the answer to that question because no president has ever attempted to do that. He certainly could try. It would probably be challenged in court, and then we would see what would happen from there. But I do think that the more immediate legal challenge for him is probably not a federal investigation. It's a state-level investigation in New York into potential financial impropriety in his real estate and tax activities there. And even if a president were able to pardon himself, a pardon issued by the president only covers federal crimes. It doesn't cover state and local crimes. So even if he got away with pardoning himself, that would not do anything to shield him from prosecution by the Manhattan District Attorney or the Attorney General of New York State. Now, we don't know what direction those investigations are going to take, but there's basically a unanimous view among legal experts that his exposure to those investigations will be far, far greater once he's out of office.
And when are we likely to see what direction those investigations are taking? I mean, they've been hanging around for a while now.
You know, we don't actually have a terribly developed sense of where those investigations stand, in part because the president has been so successful at stalling the disclosure of a whole bunch of different kinds of documents that prosecutors have requested, because he has been, up to this point, the president. And he has made these claims in these drawn-out court cases that have gone all the way up to the Supreme Court essentially, he should be immune from these document requests because he's the president, and this is legal harassment by a political adversary. And essentially, a president cannot be bothered with these matters. Well, in 2 months, he won't be the president anymore, and that argument will go away. And I would still expect him to take a pretty obstructionist approach to those investigations. But I do think that we ought to have a sense, I would think, by the spring, of how serious those investigations are and how rapidly they're going to develop once he's outside the White House.
Can you give me any insight, Alex, into Rudy Giuliani? I mean, once a respected mayor of New York, and now what? What is he doing?
Well, it's not necessarily quite as abrupt a transformation as I think it might look. If you sort of tuned into Rudy Giuliani, you know, back in the 90s, and then when he ran for president in 2008, and then more recently, it is a very, very stark transformation. But it has also been to those of us who have covered him, relatively closely over the years, kind of a gradual transformation that, by the time the 2012 presidential campaign rolled around and he was flirting with running again against Barack Obama, it was clear that he had lost a step politically, that he was not as articulate, not as sharp as he once had been, and that he was involved in a whole bunch of overseas business activities, security consulting activities that had become somewhat unseemly as a matter of political scrutiny, if you were a political candidate. In 2016, he, of course, sort of reached again for what at the time seemed to be and probably was his last chance at real relevance by attaching himself so closely to Donald Trump as a presidential candidate and hoped that he would be the Secretary of State when President Trump was inaugurated. He never actually got close to getting that job. So I think one way to interpret Rudy Giuliani's activities recently and really over the last 5 years is a guy in the late winter of his public life really desperate to stay relevant in some way, even if that, even if the way he ultimately finds to stay in the news appears to be, somewhat humiliating in that he is getting just totally ridiculed for the role he is playing in this hopeless legal campaign.
Has he got the hide of a rhinoceros? I mean, does he not see how people see him? Does he not care?
I genuinely don't know the answer to that, but I do know that he, like President Trump, inhabits a world of very conservative media outlets and conservative political donors. And it's somewhat distinct from just sort of the Republican Party elite as a whole. This is, you're really talking about a sort of entourage that comes out of talk radio, right-wing talk radio in the U.S., which is obviously very different from the conversation you and I are having. Right-wing talk radio in the U.S., the right-wing internet, the sort of Fox News environment in the U.S., and the New York sort of real estate and sort of Trump-adjacent hype empire that Giuliani is now enmeshed in. And I guess what I'm getting at is that he's certainly aware that his performances are not going over so well, but he's also surrounded by the same kind of servile court of political retainers that surrounds the president. And it's always kind of an open question how much any of those people talk straight to their boss and says, you know what, this is really a disaster.
This is the most extraordinary election, right? I mean, previously you had the COVID and you had the phenomenon of Trump and you had the whole impeachment thing, you've had the race protests, and now this ongoing rhetoric from the losing president. What do you make of it all? How does it tally with your expectations when you started being a political correspondent?
Well, certainly the standoff that we have right now is like nothing I've ever covered or ever even seen before I was a political reporter. I do think that the irony of the way the president is behaving right now in this really chaotic and in many ways traumatic year is that this has probably been the most predictable part of 2020, that the president would refuse to succeed and attack the legitimacy of the election if he lost. That, if you think back to 2016, and not many people remember this in the U.S., that immediately after he won the 2016 election, he claimed that there were millions of illegal votes. And this was part of his effort to sort of explain away why Hillary Clinton won the popular vote in spite of his winning the Electoral College. But, my point is that he attacked the legitimacy of an election that he won. So, of course, he was going to attack the legitimacy of an election that he lost. I think he has taken it further than I would have expected. And the degree to which he is still, he seems at some points to recognize that he's on his way out. He has made comments even just in the last few days that seem to indicate that, he made a comment about hoping that they, he didn't say who they was, but that they will continue with America First policies. That's not the kind of language that you use if you think that you are going to be staying in the presidency. But at the same time, he's calling into these sort of ad hoc field hearings that Rudy Giuliani and other lawyers are holding to continue spouting these conspiracy theories, and really seems at times to still be quite deeply invested in these very far-fetched conspiracy theories. And it does have, you know, something of the view of, you know, a president who, first of all, didn't expect to be defeated, and second of all, expected the election to be very, very close. And he was defeated, and the election actually was not particularly close, certainly as the popular vote was concerned. But the fact that he is still in this mode of trying to, you know, he attacks one state at a time, Pennsylvania, Georgia, saying that the results were rigged. But even if you flipped both Pennsylvania and Georgia, he still lost the election. So it really does seem like he's grasping at straws, and that at times he even knows that he's grasping at straws.
Do you think?
Do I think that he knows it?
Yeah.
I think that he knows that he is not going to be the president at the end of January. And I think that he is just sort of going through a process of sort of a public relations effort to save face. He sees it as saving face, certainly, that it's better to be seen as a victim than a loser. I don't know that that's actually true, but that's been his pretty consistent view, that he would rather his supporters believe that he was cheated out of the election than that he tried his best and he lost fair and square.
Sure, that makes sense. One question. Do state legislatures have the power to defy the popular vote and appoint their own electors? This is a question that's been asked. What's the answer?
Well, you know, you're asking me a lot of questions that I have to, if I'm going to answer honestly, I have to say I don't know. And the answer really is I don't know, and neither do the constitutional experts who argue that question on either side, that this is a hole in American election law, and it is a scary one to the people who are deeply involved in these kinds of efforts, because there is an argument to be made that based on the Constitution, based on the very, very literal language of the Constitution, only state legislatures can ultimately decide who the electors are. There's also an argument to be made, and it's, I think, based on a somewhat heftier body of evidence, that once the procedures are set, the procedures are set, and a state legislature that determines that electors are apportioned by the popular vote, well, that means that that's what happened. The state legislature can't just decide after an election to nullify the result. But the point is, this has not been tested. And I just spoke this last week to a couple of the, you know, most prominent election lawyers in both parties who said, look, we're very fortunate that this didn't go further than it did, that none of these state legislatures actually tried to do that, because that would be uncharted territory. And that this is one of these things, and there are a couple of them, a couple gaps in American election law that the 2020 election has really highlighted in a way that a future Congress ought to address, that we ought to have federal laws that really clarify these terms, because, you know, so much of the way power is transferred in the U.S. is based on these arcane rituals that have always gone more or less smoothly, with a couple exceptions, because nobody has even attempted what President Trump has attempted.
Wow. So maybe he's done you all a public service by attempting, as you've written, to subvert the election. He has exposed cracks that need fixing in the edifice of democracy.
Well, it's a public service if they get fixed, right? Because if they don't, then what he's done is just create a roadmap for the next person who wants to attack the legitimacy of the election. And if this race had been closer, you know, if it had been decided in one state, if it had been like Florida in 2000, where it was decided by one state with a margin of a little more than 500 votes out of millions cast, then a whole lot of the stuff that the president has tried might have come a lot closer to succeeding.
Many Republicans, were you surprised at how many Republicans were prepared to go along with Trump?
I wasn't, because they have, for the most part, all along. And as a party, they have generally taken this view that the most dangerous stuff that the president does is fundamentally not serious, and he will not succeed in doing it, and so it's not worth challenging him, and we just have to kind of wait for him to exhaust his interest in that idea and move on. And that the rest of the stuff that he does, whether it's on taxes or foreign policy or immigration and border control, that they at least believe that they can talk him into being, you know, somewhat more constructive than his own instincts would lead him to be. And they have had some success in that respect. But no, we've had so few examples all along of Republican profiles and courage, of people in his own party standing up and saying, you know, this thing that you did was totally unacceptable. We saw this obviously in the impeachment process, where, you know, I don't think anybody believes that, you know, you talk to Republican lawmakers off the record and in private, very, very few of them believe that everything the president did was above board and legitimate. But nobody actually votes to impeach him or censure him. And so I think that's what we're seeing now, and perhaps even more so because they now know there really is an expiration date on his presidency. And their feeling is, you know, why pick some apocalyptic fight with this guy who won't even be in charge anymore in less than 2 months?
Well, it depends how far ahead you're looking. I mean, what happens to Trumpism now? Is there any merit to the idea that he might run again in 2024?
I think there is. And I think that's, I mean, I think that's exactly the dilemma that the Republican Party is in, that he is this figure in Republican politics and American politics and American culture who is big enough to kind of block out the sun for anybody else who wants to be a real leader on the right. And that includes his own vice president, Mike Pence. It includes his secretary of state, Mike Pompeo. These are men who are absolutely planning to run for president in 4 years. And one of the challenges for them is that even if President Trump does not try to run again in 2024, he can drag out his decision for as long as he wants. And so we may well spend the next 3 years with President Trump doing a sort of will he or won't he game around the 2024 election that just freezes the candidacies of everybody else in his party. And that's a problem for the party, not just because, you know, a couple other ambitious people might not have an easy time running for president, but also because it makes it harder for the Republican Party to say what it is for other than whatever President Trump is talking about today, as long as he wants to be the biggest mouthpiece of the GOP.
You mentioned in passing his possible media ambitions, and there have been suggestions that he might set up a rival to Fox News, with which he has become disaffected. What do you think?
You know, I'm quite skeptical that he would start a media company from scratch, because he's really never done that, right? We're not talking about somebody who is one of the great startup entrepreneurs in the U.S., or somebody who has, you know, some dazzling record of acquiring companies and then making them bigger and better companies, right? This is somebody who has taken who took a family, a real estate empire, and made it a bigger and better branded family real estate empire, and then was a very successful television show host, right? The Apprentice. So it would be quite out of character with everything else he's done in his career if he were to say, you know, tomorrow I'm starting Trump News. But it is quite notable that there are a couple networks that are, you know, they don't have nearly the reach that Fox News has. They're called Newsmax and One America News. They don't have anything like the footprint that Fox has or the resources that Fox has, but they are much further right even than Fox is, and far more willing to propagate just pure conspiracy theories, you know, not even just sort of news that is skewed to the right, but information that is simply false or fictitious, particularly OAN, the second network that I mentioned. And I do think there are a lot of people in the media business generally and in the Republican Party who would not be remotely surprised to see him try to develop some kind of partnership with one of those entities, or perhaps with one of the many quite substantial right-wing news websites that's out there. I will just say that, you know, as much as he is motivated by commercial incentives, and as much as he clearly would like to make a lot of money upon leaving office, he also just loves attention, right? And one of the challenges to affiliating yourself with one network is that then you don't get to go on the other networks. So I think that one challenge for him, if he did try to say, you know, I'm going to try to, you know, build a business partnership with One America News, and we're going to call it Trump News, even though I won't actually directly manage it, is, well, does that mean that you don't get to go do an interview with NBC, or that, you know, CNN is not going to be banging down your door? And he is a man who loves the microphone of the media, almost irrespective of who is offering the microphone.
He really does love attention, right? It's the most extraordinary spectacle.
It's one of the things that I think people have struggled to understand about him, mostly because they do not believe that the simplest explanation can possibly be the right one, the behavior with the media. And they think, why is he doing this? What is his political motive or strategy here? And often there's not a political motive or strategy. He loves being on television, and he loves being the center of attention.
Just very quickly, Alex, Joe Biden then, President Biden to come, the oldest person ever to be elected president in the United States, I think. Can he heal the divisions that you and I have just been talking about?
Well, I think what he has going for him is, even though this was a closer election than I think he expected it to be, and even though, as you said, 74 million Americans stuck with President Trump, there isn't the same kind of animosity towards Joe Biden on the right that there was towards Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama before her. So I think he's certainly got a chance here. And in his political core, he is a consensus-driven politician. So in a lot of ways, you know, I don't know that he can be successful, but if he can't be successful, then I think those of us in the political press do sort of have to wonder, can anybody be successful? Or if this guy who has made his career around being a consensus builder, a moderate, a political unifier, is incapable of doing any of those things, then maybe the system is just fundamentally broken, or the political culture is just fundamentally broken.
Very quickly, let me ask you about this pardon business. Trump has pardoned his former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, who had pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI investigators about conversations with Russia's ambassador. Every president has all these pardons. President Obama dished out over 200 pardons and over 1,700 commutations, mostly to low-profile, non-violent people who were in prison. Why can the president dish out all these pardons? What is that about?
Well, it comes from the American system having been designed by a group of people, many of whom were still quite sympathetic to the idea that there's a value in having a king or a figure who has some of the powers of a king. And it is this really archaic sort of ritual that, you know, it gives, we are a democracy, but that the president has this sort of almost Roman imperial style power to pardon any crime in the federal system. What most presidents have done with it is to pardon, as you said, people who are low-level offenders or who, you know, there's some flaw in the law, or people who've shown extraordinary contrition. There have been politically scandalous pardons in the past, the pardon of Richard Nixon by Gerald Ford, the pardon of Mark Rich, a fugitive financier who was politically connected to the Democratic Party by Bill Clinton. President Trump is not the first person to use the power for, let's say, somewhat more venal purposes. But he is notable because he has used the power almost exclusively for people who he sees as sort of personally connected to him or political allies, and has shown a far less interest in the sort of, let's pardon 300 people who committed low-level drug crimes and have shown no inclination to criminality or violence since then. And that's really where the Flynn pardon stands out, that there's no argument to be made that President Trump's use of the pardon power is part of a larger agenda of sort of clemency and executive mercy.
Very good to talk to you. Thank you, Alex. Alex Burns is the New York Times political correspondent.